Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Tanya Lerman, who's a professor of anthropology at Stanford University and the author of When God Talks Back, Understanding the American Evangelical Relationship with God. She has an article in Monday's New York Times, Do As I Do, Not As I Say. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tanya Lerman.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
And your book, and to a lesser extent your article, goes a long way to answer a question that's always I've found extraordinary, is that why the Democratic Party, obviously the Republicans get elected on, rely upon or depend upon peeling off Democratic votes, working Americans who vote Republican, and who, the assumption is that they're voting against their interests, but then the Democrats don't do anything about it, but sort of feel churlish and dismissive. And you're saying that they're missing out on a huge bet here.
Yes. I think that one of the, what Democrats do when they talk about politics, they think about the outcome of their policy choices. So they think about changing social circumstances so people can be as they are and the thing, and things will go better for them. And the language that I hear in evangelical settings is a language not only about morality and character, but of transformation, changing yourself as you do deeds for other people. And I think it would help the Democratic Party if they were to adopt some of that language themselves. I think, you know, it's actually not so far from what many Democrats believe, but this sense that it's about the way that you grow through good action and become a better person, and the action is intended to help other people become better people. It's a very different way of thinking about what counts.
Well, it seems, though, that since you did such extensive field work amongst religious evangelicals here in the United States, in your new book, When God Talks Back, Understanding the American Evangelical Relationship with God, was that your intention going in? It sounds to me like you went on a learning experience here.
Yes. I mean, I knew that I was just curious about what people meant when they said that they heard God speak to them. I met this young woman who was just kind of a giggly beach Californian, and she said that if I wanted to understand her church, I should have coffee with God. And I was floored by that. I wanted to figure out what she meant, how she had that experience. I thought about religious belief much more in terms of propositions, not so much as a relationship and experience. And it was an eye-opening experience of also understanding how varied the evangelical world can be.
Well, notwithstanding the old joke that if you talk to God, you're religious. If God talks to you, you're a schizophrenic.
That's right.
But this is real, though. That's the point that you're making here, that these are real conversations and a real engagement that people have. And I, by the way, yesterday I spoke with Sister Simone Campbell, the head of Network. She's the head of the Catholic Sisters in this country, who the Pope singled out as being a radical feminist and chastened her to get back to the church doctrine and preach about abortion, contraceptive, and in support of abortion, contraceptive, and the male priesthood. And, of course, the notion that that a nun who had taken a vow of celibacy should speak about contraception struck her as being amusing. But the long and the short of it was, she spoke quite matter-of-factly about praying when we talked about the health care bill and the possibility of the Supreme Court stripping out the heart and soul of it. You know, she said, "Well, I'm just praying. I'm just praying." You know, it was so real to her. So I get what you experienced.
Yeah, I mean, I don't pass judgment on whether God is real or not real, or whether God shows up in these conversations. But what I can say is that people they sometimes come to the church very confused by what it means to hear God speak back. But what they develop is a way of recognizing their own thought experience, so that these conversations with God that they that they're having in their mind feel very real to them. It feels as if they're not just talking to themselves, but talking with an external being. I mean, I should also say that they're pretty thoughtful about this. They know perfectly well that when they're talking with God in their mind, they are can be projecting a lot of their own desires, and so they need to be really careful about what they interpret God as saying back. And yet it's a sense of, it is a real relationship.
And you also point out that in these evangelical churches where you did your field work, you met doctors, scientists, and professors, and a lot of the people you met cared about social justice.
Yes. So I thought the folks I met were a lot smarter than many secular liberals imagine them to be, and they are much more involved with helping those who suffer than many secular liberals caricature them as being. You know, evangelical spirituality is a pretty broad sweep of American culture, so there are all kinds of people in there, but the stereotype that many people have is just pretty limited.
Well, obviously, we've experienced an evangelical candidate. In fact, a number were competing for the Republican ticket on the basis of their religiosity. But of course, undoubtedly, the most authentic was Rick Santorum. And you're suggesting that when he talks about virtue, that in fact, that is not something to ridicule. That's something to emulate.
Yes, I mean. I mean, technically he's Catholic, but he certainly speaks, he grabs the attention of the evangelical world. And he said this very kind of much derided comment that the problem with government is that you go into the inner city and people are not virtuous and there is government. And he was really inviting you to conclude that government only steps in when people are immoral. I think that whatever you make of that comment, it's really helpful to represent government action as not being the backstop for immoral people, but rather that in reaching to help people in pain, we grow together as a nation and we move towards a more moral character.
So in other words, that extends, for example, to the Obama health care, which has been badly sold or not sold at all. You're suggesting, again, Tanya Lerman, a professor of anthropology at Stanford University and author of When God Talks Back, Understanding the American Evangelical Relationship with God. What you're suggesting is, in terms of the so-called Obamacare, is that the president should be describing his health care reform as a response to suffering, not as a kind of numbers-crunching solution to an economic problem.
That's right. And even when he talks about the suffering of individuals, it should not be only about their bankruptcy and only about the difficulty of the insurance. It should be about the fact that they need our help because they are in pain. And I think if he also used a language about how we grow in care and compassion, it would help to reach more people. It's not going to reach everybody. It's not going to reach all evangelicals. But this language of how political action is something that we do to grow ourselves as in our kind of in our nature. That's the way that many evangelicals imagine their moral responsibility to be.
So how do you then educate secular liberals to approach evangelicals in the way that if you were sort of an advocate for the Democratic Party? I mean, you know, the notion that the Democratic Party is anything but the old joke of Will Rogers that I don't belong to any organized political party. I'm a Democrat. I've witnessed that firsthand. They're not particularly well organized, that's for sure. So, but how would you, if you had to write a handbook for them, what would your first bullet point be?
Well, first would be respect the evangelicals. They're not, you know, many of them are very smart and sophisticated. They are, many of them share the general goals that the secular Democrat holds. And speak in a language of, I mean, spiritual transformation may be too hard for many secular liberals to be comfortable with, but speak in a language of how we develop how we develop care and character as we vote, as we help, as we choose policy to intervene in people's lives.
So why do you think it is that we had in this country a religious left at the time of the last Gilded Age, given that we're in many ways in the second Gilded Age with the disparity of wealth at extraordinary levels, and in many ways one could question the extent to which we are still a democracy and have in fact become a plutonomy ruled by oligarchs, but that's another discussion. But the long and the short of it is that during the days of William Jennings Bryan, of course famous for the Scopes trial, he was the Democratic Party standard bearer against the plutocrat, or the candidate of the plutocrats, McKinley, and he was outspent 200 to 1 or something. But he had this tremendous coalition of urban poor and rural poor who were galvanized by his preachings, you know, the cross of gold, etc. What happened to that movement, and why did it become the movement that it is today, which is clearly very much identified with the Republican Party?
I think the story actually is rooted in the 60s, and the origins of the evangelical worlds that I saw lay in the hippie Christians, and that world was a very left-wing world. That was a powerful movement. American spirituality changed pretty significantly in the 60s, and we've had other times when the Americans have sought to experience God directly and immediately, but the change from the 50s was pretty dramatic at that point. And evangelical Christianity became a new thing, and about half of those really wanted an intimate personal relationship with God. I think it's partly an accident that it became so right-wing. So there were a couple of sharp and clever politicians who were right-wing who began to move the evangelical agenda politically to the right by focusing on issues of the family and reproductive rights. So abortion and gay marriage have been the two key moral issues that have, galvanized that kind of right-wing tilt. Like Ralph Reed was one of these. And that they became the kind of, those issues became the standard bearers for voting in a particular way, and they became the lead issues. And then that movement was sort of swept off to the right. Now the tension between the two sides has become just exacerbated by being exacerbated. And there is so much caricature and hostility and stereotyping of each other that conversation just become difficult to have.
Well, the sister I was speaking with yesterday, Tanya Lehrman, her main defense was that the accusations from the Pope and the Vatican against her and the sisters in this country were about politics, not about faith, and that she considered a badge of honor that she was ministering to the poor, which is the whole point of the example of the prophet Jesus. And I'm just wondering why it is that that can't be more ammunition for an incipient religious left, the fact that the person that everybody follows was clearly, you know, he didn't carry an AK-47 and hate homosexuals and go on television and shake down poor people for money. I mean,
if Democrats were willing to use that language, I think it would be really more effective. And if they were willing to use the language also not only about helping the poor, but growing in spirit as you do so. There's actually, you know, a quarter of white evangelicals voted for the Democratic ticket that last time around. And they're the,
you're talking about 2008 for President Obama.
Yeah. And I think that the old kind of coalition, on the one hand, there's more polarization. On the other hand, you see the many evangelicals breaking with the expectation that they should vote for the Republican ticket. But they need to be, I think it's easier to talk with them if one could use a language from the Bible. I think Mr. Obama would be comfortable doing that. And also using a language that talks, I mean, he could talk to the entire country and talk about how we could grow together as a nation. And that, just that language, I think, is a more comfortable invitation than kind of, it's the economy, it's the economy, it's the economy.
So I guess in a way, you're a voice against the, in a lot of in our popular culture recently, we've had Hawkins and Hitchens and others have been questioning faith or dismissing it. And you're suggesting, as an anthropologist, I mean, is what you're telling us informed by the other work that you've done? I've assumed that you've done other field work in other countries. It seems to me that the more that you study humanity and from urban to the tribal, there's always a God somewhere. I suppose in our culture it's more monotheistic, and in so-called primitive cultures it's more pantheistic. But is there a connection there?
I think when you're an anthropologist, you're thinking about how other people understand their world. And it's, you know, it's not about saying what you think is true. It's about thinking about how other people hear. And so the challenge of communicating so that people hear is a very anthropological issue. I don't think that's what the new atheists are thinking about. And my thoughts, I mean, you know, how can you not take religion seriously? You know, 3 out of 5, maybe even 3 out of 4 Americans pray daily. This is something that really matters to people, and it's not just a dumb mistake. I mean, whatever is the case about the real reality of God, if people are taking this so seriously, they're, you know, you've got to take it seriously as an important social experience. And we know that it's good for you. I mean, the studies suggest that going to church on a weekly basis adds 2 to 3 years to your life, makes people happier. People who have a good relationship with a loving God are less vulnerable to mental illness. I mean, your immune response is better. Your inflammatory response is lower. It's in so many ways, there is a pile of evidence that suggests that religion is a healthy buffer against the world. You know, people got to take that seriously.
Well, you're on a very left-wing radio station, I have to tell you.
No, I mean, I'm not saying that people should become Christians.
I'm suggesting, Tanya, that I'm going to get run out of town, not you.
No. I just think that, you know, you got to respect people who have made this decision and that it's helpful to figure out how to talk to them rather than to make fun of them or to dismiss them. And, you know, and people know more evangelicals than they realize. Secular Democrats know more evangelicals than they realize.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today. It's a pleasure talking with you, and I hope we can have a follow-up conversation.
I'd like that. Take care.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Tanya Lehrman, a professor of anthropology at Stanford University and the author of When God Talks Back, Understanding the American Evangelical Relationship with God. She has an article in Monday's New York Times, Do As I Do, Not As I Say. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.